Hello and welcome to the IDEMS podcast. I am James Musyoka, climate data scientist at IDEMS International, and I'm here today with David Stan, the founding director of IDEMS. Welcome, David.
Hi, James.
Hi. So today we are going to be talking about climate data rescue.
Yes, this is something where we've been doing quite a lot on this over the years, but things have really moved in the last 6 months to a year.
Yes, we have been involved in quite a number of countries helping them to rescue their data. And I think of recent, there's the six countries that we worked with, the WMO, and a few more countries under UPIXA. And it's been really, I think it's been an important piece of work, generally, helping the Met services to rescue their data.
Well, we've been doing bits of work like this for a long time, but I feel what's different with these recent countries is that we've potentially identified why big data rescue projects are failing and how to fix that.
Yeah, I think in the number of countries we have been to, we have seen that they have had data rescue projects and the data have been rescued in quotes. The projects have been ticked complete, but the data has not been in the daily operational use, basically. In most of these countries, the data has always been in a separate, you know, stored separately from the central database system. And I think that has been the main challenge here that we have been finding in many of these countries.
Can I just be clear? Because the statement, as you've put it, leads to a conclusion which we found to be false. The statement that the problem is that the data which is rescued is not in the climate data management system is exactly a statement which I've heard in the past over the years, where the end of a data rescue project should be the data in a climate data management system. And in essence, in some of the countries, we found, well, that's been done, that's ticked off. The problem is it never gets out of the climate data management system it was put into. And if it never gets out, then you never have the quality control on it as part of the data rescue to the extent you need to make the data useful.
Yeah, I think that is the case in some countries. Yeah, generally, I think the problem is that the data are not in use, basically, the data that have been rescued. But yes, in some other countries, where I think what I said is actually true, that the data is not even, is a forgotten thing, basically. It's stored away and nobody remembers where it is. And it's not even in the database to begin even thinking about using it.
But in all cases that we have, this is a number of countries now, in all cases, the point is the data may be or may not be in the climate data management system, but it's not in use.
Yes, that's the point. Yeah, exactly.
And that's the key point. And that's the insight that we've had over the last 6 months to a year, that actually a proper successful climate data rescue project is only finished once the data is being used for something.
Yeah.
And once we've got that as an insight, actually it changes the end goal, not by much, but by enough that we think that once it's used for something, it is more reasonable to expect it would be used for more things. The point is the barrier to using it for the first thing is quite high. And this is what we now believe we could actually, we're looking to try and do. And we have a few countries where we've had the chance through EPIXA to say, well, let's use it for EPIXA and actually identify how much work it is to get the rescued data to the stage where it can be used for an application like EPIXA.
Yeah. But David, it just takes me back when I see these situations. I mean, I thought the whole purpose of data rescue is to increase the data that is available for daily use or for operational use. Why is it the case that these data rescue projects don't get to that point?
So I think the question is a really good one, and it's a question which I'm sure many people are asking, because these data rescue projects have been World Bank funded, they've been funded by the World Food Programme, many big UN organizations and other partners, because of the importance of the historical climate data. And I think the point which I think, or the insights that I feel we've had now, which is maybe slightly different from what's happened in the past, is that a lot of effort has been built on systems where the data rescue is done by different people than the applications. It's a different team. There's no overlap between the people who are rescuing and managing the data and the people who are looking to use the data. And that disconnect has been, in some sense, deliberate, because these are different tasks and the projects are often different. You can't wait a number of years for the data rescue to happen before your applications happen. So even if they're both in the same project, they're done by different teams, and the relationships between them are disjoint, because in the project, having the applications depend on the data rescue would be a risk for the project. And so it's a bit the nature of project funding which has led to this sort of division of tasks, with the expectation that once those tasks are all done, they will come together. But what we found is that that coming together is much harder than people anticipated. And then it doesn't happen as part of those projects. The data rescue goes for the course of the project, and you tick the boxes that it's now in your climate data management system, or it's available on a CD, or it's backed up on a hard drive somewhere. And that's the end of the data rescue part of the project. And that was happening in parallel to the applications part, which did not depend on the data rescue, because otherwise that's too big a risk. This is all part of risk management. We've done this in projects, in EU projects and others, where to be able to reduce the risks to the project of not meeting the deliverables, you make sure that the dependency between the streams of work are minimized. But that, by definition, creates the wrong incentives in this context.
I hear what you say, that data rescue projects are, they are often not linked to an application, so to speak. The rescue in itself is what they are funding, not for any particular application. But not to paint the National Met Services in bad light, but I thought when the data is rescued, then the Met Services who are using the daily data would then get to take advantage of the data that has been rescued and begin to use it. What do you think is the bottleneck there that is making these Met Services not to jump onto this opportunity, which is there? The data has been rescued for them to use it. Why is that step not being taken, really? Because what we are finding is Met Services have this data, these repositories of data rescued, and they are not just using them. Their daily, day-to-day activities involve using meteorological data for maybe forecasting and agroclimatic bulletins and all that. So,
Exactly. These are wonderful examples, because both of these depend on the latest data, not the historical data. And so what they're really doing, and what Met Services, the great majority of their effort is really based around using the latest data. We're getting the systems in place to have the latest data come in and use it for short-term forecasts, so that they can look after airports, and so they can do all sorts of really important tasks which require the latest data rather than the historical data.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that could probably explain why there's a lot more effort than historical data. Am I correct there?
I believe so. And there's a lot of structures in place for these forecasting components, because this is really the work where Met Offices are extremely valued. You can't have an airport unless you have a Met Office station there, doing local weather forecasts, predicting when there will be a problem, when there will be weather conditions that will affect the airport. And there's many other cases where the short-term forecast, the immediate forecast, is really valued by many people in a country. And so that's where a lot of not just the effort goes, but also the training. A lot of the training around Met Offices is on the forecast data, the immediate data, the collection of immediate data rapidly to get it to put into models and so on. That's where the training lies, a great majority of it, and a lot of the effort goes. And it's not that that effort is ill-placed. It's that there is another role Met Offices can and should play, which has been of increasing importance given the climate change and the importance of actually looking at the historical records to understand how things were, how things are, and how they might be changing. So that long-term perspective has become increasingly important. And that's something where Met Offices have not generally been trained as much in that. They haven't recruited as many staff with those skills, and they don't actually have teams set up as much to be able to use that and manage that. And it's not a failing, I would argue, of the Met Offices per se. It's just this change of the need that has emerged over the last decade or two, where the historical data is, I think, of increasing importance.
Yeah. So to speak, you're talking about data skills basically within the meteorological services community.
Absolutely. And there's many who recognize this internationally. There's many Met Services who are taking this very seriously. One of the things which is, of course, interesting and in competition with this is the work of the, if you want, remote sensing products, your satellite data, your AI data, and there's all sorts of products which are now coming out, which can give you historical rainfall for 30, 40, 50 years, but not real data. They are simulated data or they're estimated data based on very good algorithms. And the problem is that the accuracy of that data is as good as you can do right now, and they may well improve as we go forward. But we are finding consistently that they don't actually represent certain features of the historical climate record. In particular, they don't represent extreme events well. They tend to average out, and on average, they're quite good. But the importance of extreme events cannot be understated, or cannot be overstated, sorry, because an extreme climatic event causes devastation on occasions. And so either a real dry spell or a wet spell, or a particular storm, or a particular heat wave, or a particularly rare cold event, all of these can be devastating for crops, for landscape. They can have floods. There's all sorts of consequences that can come from this.
Yeah, and so actually, I think, yeah, I agree with you that actually we therefore need to rescue more ground-based observations to be able to understand how to use these products. So actually, this emphasizes that rescuing the real data is still very important, even in the event, in the wake of these satellite data sources. They are
Absolutely.
increasingly being available now.
Well, the satellite data sources, the reanalysis sources, which are simulated
Exactly.
and coming out of models, there's now AI products which are coming out as well. There's a lot of these products, but a lot of them have the same characteristics. And there's good reason why they have the same characteristics. Actually, being good on average is probably what's desirable for many of those products, but it doesn't capture the historical extremes, which is so important because extremes are becoming part of our consciousness as every year seems to become an extreme year in the current climate context.
Yeah, great. I was wondering whether we could close by, from our experience and from all these countries we've been working in, we've come up with some concept called the hourglass approach to data rescue. And actually, I was wondering whether you could explain what that means, because I think it's quite an important thing that we've come up with to help with the data
Absolutely.
rescue.
The hourglass is an analogy which is used in many contexts where you have many different ways the data could originally be, and it could be rescued in many different ways and to many different places. Rather than worrying about the data rescue going into the centralized database, we found that's actually a barrier to it getting used, because it can sit in the centralized database and not be used. The key we find is to accept that data coming from many different sources needs to be rescued, however it's rescued, and then you need to be able to take it and put it into a common format, a common system, whereby it can then be used. And that common system is the narrow part of your hourglass, where everything can come in to a common format, a recognizable format, which can then be reused for many different applications and in many different ways. And what we think is that if you think of this hourglass approach, then what we can be doing is you can actually, your data rescue is not finished when you get it to that narrow part of the hourglass. You need at least one application to demonstrate that the data is actually usable and useful for application. And then, of course, the other applications, they don't need to know about the complexity of the bottom half of the hourglass. They can now just attach themselves from the narrow piece of the data which is now usable for application. So this is not so different from the idea of a centralized database, and that is one way of achieving this. It's just that we found that actually achieving it through a centralized database, too much of the effort is then spent on things which aren't helping us get through the hourglass and out the top to these many applications. And we think that our hypothesis now, and this is what we're trying out with ePixel as a first application, is that if we can actually get the systems in place so that your hourglass, the bottom part is what the data rescue does, and a single thread comes up from that and from that vision where others could then get attached from the narrow part of the hourglass, that's where we feel that we could have lots of applications starting to be built out of the rescued data, that the rescued data is then ready to be used. Now, that's not trivial to achieve, and there's many different ways that you can get to that narrow piece. We found in practice that actually the narrow piece for us, for historical daily climatic data, is often a data format which is then used within a software analysis package. And that actually getting the data so it can get to that data format is what means it can be ready for many different applications. Because that data format can then be used for climate normals, for climate change analyses, for comparisons of satellite to station data, for ePixel. Many different applications can all come from that single climate data format. And it doesn't matter whether the data comes into that single analysis format from a single database, which is ideal, or from Excel and from other data sources. That's fine as well. As long as we can get it into that analysis format, which enables us to produce these many products.
So basically, data is not rescued. It's not fully rescued until it's being used, basically.
And the key point to that, which we find time and time again, is that the data rescue projects, even though they've had some form of quality control, as soon as you try and use it for an application, there's more quality control that's needed. And
Yeah.
often that quality control should be part of the data rescue itself, but people don't recognize it's needed until they try and use it for application. And then they give up because they don't have access to the rescue piece. So if the application is part of the data rescue, our hypothesis is this will ensure that the rescued data is then reused for many different applications and reusable.
Interesting. Right. Yeah, it's been a very interesting discussion.
We should
Yeah.
have a follow-up where we actually discuss some of the real use cases where this is starting to sort of play out in Zambia, in Zimbabwe, and where it's hard work. We don't want to trivialize this. This is not something which is easy. It is something which really requires work. So
Yeah,
let's have
and
another episode on that.
interesting. Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.